Hello everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host. I'm recording late, it's 1 a.m. in Reykjavik, Iceland, as I'm recording now, on Monday the 13th of May. I've just finished writing up some notes about a game called 1000 Times Resist that I've been playing across the last week. It's a game that I've been looking forward to a lot since the demo first dropped. It's a very, very intriguing, interesting game, but I'm happy to say that it really outstripped my expectations of just how good it might be. It's really something special, and so that game will be the featured game of this episode. I've got quite a lot of notes, so I think I'll keep the intro short today, but I did want to give a little shout out to the crazy week in indie games that we've just had. On May the 9th, five games came out. We got Animal Well, we got Little Kitty Big City, we got Cryptmaster, Crow Country, and 1000 Times Resist, all coming out on the same day, which seems kind of bananas. But it was really heartening to be online on this day. I actually spent a lot of the day talking to people and just following the general excitement on Twitter as people started to talk about these games, download all of these games. They had a festival-like atmosphere in a way that I wasn't expecting. And given that Hades 2 went into surprise early access this week and Ludo Narracon was starting up, the Fellow Traveller Narrative Games Festival that's online and happening now, actually. Social media really popped off for these games in such a good way. There were game developers all tweeting about indie games. Everyone was going indie game crazy. The whole gamersphere seemed kind of giddy. And it actually gave me a flashback to this time last year. Tears of the Kingdom came out a year ago today as I'm recording, on May the 12th, 2023. And I remember that the whole gamersphere was just, it was almost like a national day of celebration for gamers. People were taking days off work. The place where I was working at the time gave us a day of holiday to go and play Zelda. And May the 9th had that kind of energy, but rather than it being the latest Zelda game, it was five indie games that all came out at once. I really do hope that this lift that they all got from being part of this little graduating group of long-awaited games that came out to the public helps them all along. I have played a little of all of them. I have all of them in my Steam library now. I've been very much enjoying Animal Well, and I will get to it now that 1000 Times Resist is complete. I've been having a really good time with Little Kitty Big City, actually. It's the runt of the litter, perhaps. It's a small game about being a cat. And it's actually been a really nice wind-down game. There were nights after I played an hour of 1000 Times Resist or more where I was just lying staring at the ceiling at bedtime, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to go and swat some plants off ledges and just be a cat for a while. And it really did help my mind to unwind. Cryptmaster I'm planning to play more of. Crow Country is doing very, very well. It seems to have really hit a chord with survival horror people. So it was a great week for indie games. And in the ocean of bad news that we've been getting in the video games industry, it was just nice that everyone focused on what we're all here for, really, which is just exciting new games. I'm going to keep the intro short, but just before we get into the review, allow me to mention that this is a Patreon-supported podcast. So whether you're a first-time listener who likes what you hear today, or a long-term listener who's been listening to the podcast for a while, you can support this podcast at patreon.com/gamingintheWild, for which you will get an invite to our patron-only Discord server, bonus episodes, behind-the-scenes posts on Patreon, and a whole load of other perks. So if you're interested in supporting this show, it's patreon.com/gamingintheWild. It starts at $1 a month or more if you want, and I will put a link to that in the show notes. And a big thank you to all of my existing patrons, and thank you to you if that's something you would consider. And with that said, let's move on and talk about this wonderful game, 1000 Times Resist. So 1000 Times Resist is a game developed by Sunset Visitor, directed by Remy Liu, with a soundtrack by Lena Cacho and Drew Redman that we're listening to right now. And this particular track has several variations on the soundtrack, which has a total of over 80 tracks on it. And this piece of music has been going around my mind since I started playing the game, so I've chosen to use it here, but the whole soundtrack is quite lovely. The game was published by a fellow traveller. It doesn't yet have a Metascore, there aren't enough reviews in for it just yet, but the reviews that are in have come in very positive. It got 8 out of 10s on Eurogamer and Games Hub, 8.5 on Destructoid, and I think there are more on the way. Natalie Flores reviewed it for Paste and said it's the kind of game that can leave you feeling transformed. Few other games as bold and brave, as brilliant as this one. Throughout its 15 hours, there's a palpable eagerness to take the risks that many other teams would shy away from. Games Hub gave it 4 out of 5 and said it's a little longer than it needs to be and quite convoluted in places, but they were ultimately glad for the game's occasional lumpiness because of the creative freedom it suggests. I think that that's generous praise and also generous critique, and I'll be echoing some of that in my own review. And this game didn't get as many reviews as I was expecting as yet, but the people who sought this game out really did do it justice. There are some very good articles online about this game now. And if you are a writer who is listening now, a games reviewer, games podcaster, then please do go and check this game out. Go and pitch it to your editor, because I think it's a game that deserves wider coverage than it has received so far. As for how long to beat, it doesn't have a time on the site yet. My time clocked in at 15 hours, like Natalie Flores, and maybe 16. But I have seen reports of people getting through it a little bit faster. And I did linger around in the main hub area, getting every bit of dialogue that I could possibly find, and doing a couple of extra memory objects that you can seek out if you wish. So maybe you could shave some time off that. And the developers described this one by saying, 1,000 years in the future, humanity is all but extinguished, and a disease spread by an alien occupation keeps the survivors underground. You are Watcher. You dutifully fulfill your purpose in service of the All-Mother until the day you learn a shocking secret that changes everything. And my take on this one is that 1,000 Times Resist is an art game magnum opus. It's ostensibly a mesmerizing sci-fi mystery about a far future society, but it never stops growing, weaving a complex tapestry of memorable characters, far-reaching subject matter, poetic dialogue, and unforgettable moments, both intimate and shocking. It's a dizzyingly intelligent masterpiece that I will be thinking about for years to come. So safe to say that I loved this game. This is the kind of game that made me start this podcast, to be honest with you. I always say at the start of the show, it's a podcast focused on artistic and creative games. And this is one of those top tier artistic games that just does so very much. I've almost felt intimidated to talk about it as I've been playing through the game. It has so much going on. It has so many overlapping subjects and such interesting perspective on so many things. And it evokes so much on your journey throughout the game that I was wondering how to talk about it. And even though I've got a couple thousand words of notes here, I'm still not quite sure how to talk about this game, but I'm going to give it a try. So stick with me as I talk about 1,000 Times Resist. So the scenario of this game is that we play as Watcher. Watcher is a young woman wearing glasses and a blue jumpsuit. She seems to be a priestess of sorts when we first meet her, in a far future sisterhood that worships a human deity called the All-Mother. And this sisterhood seems to be all that is left of humanity in this far future. We learn that humanity was driven underground and is all but extinct after an alien invasion by a race called the Occupants. And their arrival precipitated a plague where most of humanity died from a disease that makes you cry until you die. And as far as we know, the sisterhood is pretty much what is left of humanity. They live in an underground bunker. They wear masks to protect themselves from germs. They live in a sterile, all-female facility called the Orchard. There are various sisters that govern this underground themselves, according to the doctrine of the All-Mother, from whom they were all born. The All-Mother is an absentee, immortal matriarch figure who fights the occupants in a forward position. Occasionally, the All-Mother will call back to the bunker and ask for one of the sisters to come and join her on the front lines, at which time they board a train and they never return. And one of the many, many understudies is anointed to take that sister's place. And we learn of all of this through conversations, through flashback communions, through cutscenes, through time skips, and it is all jumbled together in a really interesting way. We are flashing back and forward in time. We are moving from place to place through real-world contemporaneous scenes, through distant memories, through flashbacks, conversations. It's all it's all meshed together, and we get little fragments here and there as we move through this story. So you really have to pay attention to what people are saying. And the game, straight off the bat, presents several big mysteries. Why do all of these women look the same? What is going on with the All-Mother? What is going on with the occupants? And the game immediately puts some wrinkles into it as well. We find out quickly from a leak from the other side that the All-Mother is perhaps not everything she says she is, that the combat with the occupants is possibly not happening in the way that the sisters have been led to believe, and so there are cracks in the system right from the off. But I'm getting ahead of myself here, so as far as how this plays out in gameplay, 1000 Times Resist is mostly a third-person game. It has a very cool, minimal art style that you may have seen on the key art and the various social videos that are going around and trailers. It has a nice, colourful, clean, crisp, illustrated kind of art style. And we play as the blue-clad watcher, the observer, who communes with the All-Mother in flashback visions called communions. And we play as the watcher in her waking life, walking around the orchard, the facility where all the sisters live. We explore the facility, we carry out the watcher's duties, we go drinking in the shell bar at night, talking to people. And we spend a lot of time talking to the other sisters. There are 6 sisters in total, and they are kind of leaders of sorts in this settlement full of lesser clones called Shells, and the 6 key sisters. We have the principal, who wears red and is an overseer with a high office that overlooks the whole orchards. We have the fixer, clad in green, who is responsible for keeping the place running. She's a handywoman and machinist. We have the pink healer, who is in charge of healthcare and bringing into being more sisters. We have the purple knower, who is responsible for knowledge. She has an extremely patchy library of a pre-cataclysm humanity, more dedicated to the memories of the All-Mother. And we have the orange-clad Bang Bang Fire, who is the head of security in military matters. And it's a temporary role for these sisters. When they graduate and go on the train to the All-Mother, they are replaced by other sisters who are training in each of those fields. So it's like a constant self-renewing cycle, in a way. And as well as playing through the orchard and the Watcher's day-to-day life, we also play through her communions. These are dreamlike visions that are part of the Watcher's duties, where she enters into vision sequences that consist of the All-Mother's early memories and memories from throughout her life. They're kind of flashbacks. They are surreal. They are strange. They flash back and forward in time. And this is where things start to get more complicated and the sci-fi story takes some strange turns. Because all of the communions are visits to the All-Mother's memories, her childhood before the fall of humanity, her school life. The invasion happened while she was in high school, so that's a key moment in her life. What happened to her during the fall and afterwards, and how she ended up being the sister's godhead matriarch and turned from Iris, the troubled teen, into the All-Mother. And the communion sequences are very interesting. They are surreal. They are sometimes scary. They have a little extra gameplay than the running around you have in the orchard. There's a hookshot sequence where you will shoot through surreal environments by latching onto distant points. There is a time skip mechanic where you can use the shoulder buttons to skip back and forward, sometimes between eras, sometimes through a rapid fire sequence of events. Sometimes that is used in puzzles or in storytelling. So this is the most juicy part of the game when you are in communion with the All-Mother. And it's also where many of the game's themes are introduced. There's an initial long sequence about the All-Mother's early life. That's the real start of the game. It seems to have 4 different beginnings. But I would say that the most meaty beginning of the game is Iris's first communion, where we go to explore Iris's high school. We flash back to Iris's high school days. And as we are exploring this school, there is a very lyrical twist in that we can flick between 2 eras. One is pre-apocalyptic, when the school is full and bustling with pupils and teachers. There are whispers of strange things happening out in the world. People are just learning of what is about to happen. But we can also flick forward in time to a far future, where the school is blacked out and dark, where the tables and desks have been used as barricades, where the med bay has been used as all of the pupils died, pretty much. And there is poetry and sadness in flicking between these two times. We will see an easel where someone is painting a boy and struggling to capture him and talk to both the subject and the artist. And if we flash forward into the future, we see the easel, the children are gone, and we can look at the portrait and remark about how the drawing came out and what it holds in its eyes and all of these kinds of things. And there are lots of little instances of that, of poetry made by looking at humanity before the fall and after in these small personal vignettes. And it really sets the tone for the kind of sensitivity and deft expert storytelling that really characterizes this game. And these communion sequences will show us all parts of Iris's life. We see memories of her mother and father, and we learn their stories. They have their own histories and their own issues, their own personalities. They emigrated to Canada from Hong Kong in difficult circumstances. We learn about an ill-fated friendship with a girl called Zhao and how Iris became the All Mother. And it's a complex soup of autobiographical information, of biographical information about Iris. It touches on all kinds of themes. It starts to weave into this sci-fi story elements of high school racism, of generational trauma, of rebellion, friendship, cruelty, and how all of these things culminated in Iris's current exalted all-mother role. And it's a really engaging journey, and given how much is going on in this story, it's super compelling and coherent, and it holds together, even as it is delivered to you in this atomized style, where you're flicking between time periods, getting different perspectives from different unreliable narrators, and just trying to piece together what it all means. And I'm not going to do like a plot deep dive in this particular podcast. I may do that later. I do hope to talk to the game's director, Remy, about this game, and maybe that will be the time for a spoiler cast. But in this podcast, I'm not going to go much past here in terms of where the story goes. I really do think that it's better for you to find that out for yourself. But I do think that it would be fun to talk about just all of the things that this game does so well, as I have lavished so much praise on it from the beginning of this podcast. And there is a lot that I like about this game. There's a lot of little things that just add up to something very special. And the dialogue in this game struck me right from the off, in that school sequence that I was describing. When we flick into the past, we meet school children and teachers that have very snappy, throwaway, contemporary dialogue. They are almost Mean Girls adjacent. It has high school drama to it. And then when we flick into the later time, where there are just a few humans in hazmat suits, and they have these glowing pink masks that cast strange shadows, and they speak in such deep hopelessness. The contrast is stark and remarkable. And it's reflected in the voice acting. When you flick back in time, you get these ebullient or melancholic children, school kids rather, students, talking about their hopes and dreams and aspirations and art and science and music. And they're learning how to use cameras. They're studying biology. One of them, who thinks she has the disease, is studying her own cells with the hope that she can figure things out and have some kind of breakthrough. She's studying a disease in her own body. And then when we flick into the far future, the people speak in such sad voices. They are just so beaten. They have seen the end of everything. And just flicking between those two things, the tone of the dialogue, the tone of the voice acting, was very special. And I like the way that the dialogue in this game switches gears a lot in this way. Like the way that the sisters snap at each other and comfort each other. There is an intimacy, a frustration, a mutual support, sometimes hate. You get the whole range of emotions just rolling through them in a really interesting way. But then at other times, the dialogue is very different. We'll have the maternal scolding of Iris's mother, who has her own shit going on. Iris's father, who speaks in sort of soothing tones and tries to hold the family together. And then in other times, we will meet Iris later, when she is the All Mother, and she has these calm incantations that she speaks over and over, just like lines of poetry. The very first lines of the game are, "There is an us and a pattern we are threading. There is a nearness and its gravity is echoing." And so we get these gear changes between spine-tingling poetry, between authentic feeling conversation. There is not a lot of exposition in the game, I think. A lot of what is delivered to us is delivered through conversation, through ritual, through saying, through all of these interesting modes of dialogue. And I think that the voice actors do an incredible job of keeping it real. And the game's visual style has a lot to offer as well, not only in the near-adjacent high fashion of the sisters and their outfits, which look both functional and like high couture, with their utilitarian masks and equipment boxes strapped to them, with their platform stiletto heels and their Louise Brooks bobs and glasses, but also in the use of colour. Each sister is a colour, and each sister's domain in the orchard is designated and designed around that signature colour. There are shades of light that seem to follow certain characters around. And in the architecture as well, in the cold curve of the Shell Bar, in the Hong Kong neon of the old downtown, the domestic details of the tiny flat that Iris grew up in, and the blunt functionality of the high school, the labyrinthine future architecture of the orchard. There's just a feast of stuff to look at in the game. It is all so nicely put together. The camera moves very nicely around these areas. Sometimes we have camera control. Sometimes it is taken from us with fixed viewpoints. Sometimes it's side-scrolling or overhead. The camera and the architecture, spaces and design add a huge amount to the game. And then there are the communions themselves, which take us to very different places. Sometimes familiar, sometimes strange and surreal. These are more like dream space set pieces that relate to installation art or theatre design. These communions are often like dreams. They are like memories that feel like dreams. They have a dreamlike quality. We will walk through the high school, which at first seems functional, but we will end up in a gym where scores of silhouetted bodies are frozen, floating in the air, with yellow light streaming past them. We will go into a mysterious installation where we flick through moments in time using the time skip mechanic, like a picture book that tells a terribly unfolding story. We will find exploded versions of familiar places, or suddenly find ourselves in locations we've only heard mention of in speech, and feel like we are snapping into intimate moments that we've only heard spoken so far. And the game's violence is impactful too. It happens quickly, it's sometimes brutal, it's sometimes shocking. After all of this Apple Store cleanliness and old world neatness and bustle, it sometimes comes in a way that is strangely aesthetic. There are spurts and sloshes of blood in the game that slap across those clean white surfaces in painterly patterns. The way that Iris's legs give out from under her after she is stabbed in the introduction of the game, like a gazelle after being shot. There's a sharp edge to all of the violence in the game. It never felt commonplace or cheap. It always felt heavy and shocking. And as gamers, we know that's almost never the case. And the way that all of this complex, overlapping subject matter is handled is also very graceful. There is a cultural specificity about the game that I really admired as well, in the shape of Iris's relationship with her family, her life as a girl, as a student, the texture of her school experience as a second generation immigrant coming from China to Canada. And I struggle for words here, so I'll borrow some from Alexis Ong, who reviewed the game for Eurogamer, and said, "It is simply not a game made for the white gaze, and I think that is beautiful." I want wanted to talk about this game in terms of religion as well. The cult of Iris and the All Mother has deep religious connotations to it. There's a lot to mine into with that as well. We find out early in the game that the All Mother, Iris, revered and holy, was a bit of a shitty person in a younger life. She was cruel, she was uncaring, she was at times unstable, but she has somehow ended up being the root of this pseudo-religious future society that has lasted 1,000 years. And it's a funny thought experiment in a way. I remember growing up in Christianity as a child and just listening to what was being said in church. And my young brain couldn't quite parse these stories of the Immaculate Conception and the original sin. None of it ever rang true to me. I blossomed early into an atheist, and my parents supported that. But when I think about it now, if you look back to the biblical stories, we can see the ways in which very human events might have been twisted into certain expedient shapes, and how these out-of-whack shapes have echoed down the ages and become strange cult-like things that are just surreal, like the wine being the blood of Christ, all of that strange Christian mumbo-jumbo at the end of the day. But here, the Jesus figure is Iris, the center of it all, a flawed and troubled girl with all kinds of issues. And her issues, her cruelty, her brutality are written into scripture, glossed over, bent into similarly strange shapes that distort the truth. And we start to think of them as being on a continuum. We learn why Iris is this way. We learn how Iris was brought up and what are the reasons behind her upbringing, how her parents were the way they are, and how they passed their troubles on to Iris, and how that echoes and echoes down the generations. And you can probably tell from what I've said that this game touches on things that most games don't even approach. There is so much in the game that it became overwhelming to me in a way. I felt intimidated to talk about this game in a way that I haven't felt intimidated about talking about any game previously. And this has been a meandering review as a result, necessarily, I would say. And I think that that's a compliment to the game. I do tend to take pride in being able to talk about complex things in a way that makes them feel simpler, to pull them apart and look at the pieces and to make sense of them. But there is art that evades me in that way, in that analytical look. There is visual art that does it, like Yayoi Kusama or Tomoko Takahashi. There is music that does it, like East by Joanna Newsom. It's just bigger than the sum of its parts and too much to breathe in easily. Just all of the best shit, really. I think the first time that any game had that effect on me, it was Kentucky Route Zero. It was the first time that I felt that space inside of a game. It just kept layering and building upon itself with poetry and politics, mystery and magic, until there wasn't a single bright pole star to follow in understanding the game. And instead of following like a crisp, guiding clarity, it instead traced a descriptive path from point to point. And something else happens at that moment, where instead of following one bright point in your understanding of a piece of art, you have to relax a little. You have to relax your eyes. And instead of seeing one bright star, you start to see the whole night sky instead. It's a very powerful sensation of being inside something vast. It's rare, but I think very good art does this for me sometimes, where I stop trying to hold on to and parse every detail, because there are too many to hold at a point. And so you just have to relax, trust the author, trust the work, let the whole thing spin around you and just soak it in. I've described this as a feeling of letting go of the steering wheel. And I do think of it as a form of surrendering to a work in a way. It's one of the best feelings. And I don't know if that has made sense or done the game justice, but that's the feeling that I got playing 1,000 times Resist. I normally round out reviews by running through the good points and the bad points of the game. I think I've listed out a lot of good ones here. There are a few bad. There isn't that much that I want to talk about. I think that perhaps the game is a little too long. There were a couple of chapters towards the end where we went down rabbit hole after rabbit hole, and I started to become a bit confused. I think I'm going to have to play the game again. I am going to play this game again. It's a huge work. But I think that being overlong in the case of a game like this could almost be seen as indulgence that becomes generosity. It's just giving you more of the game. There were a couple of fleeting gameplay annoyances that I will glance on. The orchard itself is difficult to navigate. You can circle around locations where you know you need to go, but it's just a very labyrinthine environment. It never particularly felt intuitive. I didn't get to know the space in quite the way that I would have liked, even on the fifth or sixth or seventh visit. And I did get stuck a couple of times in the game. There are times where you are supposed to start flicking through the time mechanic, and I hadn't realized that that mechanic had come into play. I'd been walking through environments, taking it all in, having conversations, and then just come to a dead end. And there were a couple of frustrating moments where I just missed the primer, the little animation that shows that the time mechanic has now come into play. I actually thought I'd hit a bug at one point, but I had just missed that mechanic kicking in. I would also say of the ending that I would perhaps have liked some more resolution. I was hungry for more resolution at the end of the game. I felt like there were so many questions that I still had, but after tripping through this vast, vague, tangled, poetic story, I think I will learn to love what is here. So all in all, this game really took me by surprise. I mean, I played the demo a year ago, and it was one of the very rare instances where a demo was arresting enough for me to make an episode about it. Normally I would give it a mention and wait for the full game. I've covered it twice since, so I always knew that this game was going to be special, but playing through it, I'm just so incredibly impressed by everything that it does. It is a one-off. It is a magnum opus. I think it is a modern masterpiece. That is 1,000 times Resist. So I hope you enjoyed that review of 1,000 Times Resist. The game is out now on Steam and Switch. I played it on my ROG Ally. It ran very well. I sometimes had to bump the power up to the top power profile to get the game to run. I don't know how it runs on Switch. Remy has posted out some side-by-side screenshots. Looks like it takes a bit of a resolution hit on Switch, but apparently it runs well. I am hoping to get Remy onto the podcast to talk about the game. I have a lot of questions, so hopefully that will happen in the next couple of weeks. So you'll be hearing me talk about 1,000 Times Resist again. I think in that podcast, if that takes place, I will go a little deeper. Maybe we'll drop a spoiler warning and go into the weeds a little more. But that's it for this episode. If you have played 1,000 Times Resist and you have thoughts about it, then you can reach out and talk to me about it. I would love to talk about the game. Find me on Twitter as Gaming in the Wild. You can join the Discord if you become a patron at patreon.com/gamingin the wild. We have a dedicated channel now with various people playing through the game and talking about their experience too. You can also email me at johnisgaminginthewild@gmail.com. If you are listening on Spotify or Apple, I really appreciate star ratings and reviews to help other people find the podcast. And there is also a YouTube channel where I post different extra content if you want more. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves and each other, and bye-bye for now.